Hey, how is everybody? Are you good? You're here? Fantastic. Okay, well, you know the tests are graded. They're online. You can review them anytime during my office hours or in lab whenever you want to see them. It's fine with me. And, oh, I got to check this thing. Just came loose. Larry. It turns off. But this is just perfect. Okay, it's still working. Nice. So today is March 18th. This is Bio 231, and we're going to start the nervous system chapter. And we're going to look at the schedule in just a second. I'm going to turn down some of these lights. Which ones do we like off? We like those off, and that one on, and that one off. Okay, so the schedule is on the right-hand side, and we said it was the 18th. And indeed, we're going to start chapter 12 today. And those are the page numbers that you should be reading in chapter 12. And that was the last test that you took on Monday, on the 16th. The other thing that you notice on the schedule is that there are practicums next week, right? The Monday labs and the Wednesday labs both get a second practicum. And does anybody know what's going to be on that second practicum? Yep, labs 4, 5, and 6. We call that unit number 2 in the lab manual. Anything in those pages except for shoulder. I'm not going to put shoulder on the test. All right, it will probably be spaced evenly. The questions will be spaced evenly per chapter, which means, what, I don't know, 14 questions each for every chapter. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule? After the practicum, you got spring break. So that's pretty good. So then you can get ahead, start reading some of these other chapters, maybe do some of the online assignments, get ahead in the class so you're not all jammed by the time the last week comes to class. So don't forget that last week of class, there is a lecture exam and a practicum. The Monday class just gets the practicum, but the Wednesday labs get the lecture exam and the last practicum on the same day. So don't get caught short with that. Okay, so any questions? I hear somebody has a question back there. Anybody have a question? Yo. Okay, so don't make any noise. Please stop talking so that you don't disturb anybody else around you. All right, I don't mind if you talk to each other, but I don't really want you to disturb anybody else that might be listening in, okay? All right. Okay, so we're going to start nervous system, chapter 12. And let's start with the basic divisions of the nervous system. And here is a really good slide that shows basically what our nervous system does. All right? It can perceive things in our external environment or internal environment. What we see right here is some kind of stimulus that's coming from outside the body, namely light. All right? So light bounces off this object, and in order for you to perceive light, what is the first thing that you need to perceive that stimulus? You need a, and it's not labeled on the slide, so we're going to label some things on the slide. You need a sensor, right? So this eye right here, we're going to call that a sensor. And what a sensor is able to detect is a stimulus, right? So maybe you want to put an arrowhead on this dotted line, put a little arrow right here, label this dotted line stimulus, right? And then label the eye receptor. And then that information has to get into the central nervous system for your appreciation of that particular stimulus. And so there is a neuron that takes that information from the receptor and brings it into the central nervous system. So this area right here, which kind of looks like a pale blue to me, this is your peripheral nervous system. Maybe jot that down. Wow, there's a lot missing from this slide. Okay, jot down peripheral nervous system. So this neuron that brings information into the central nervous system, we call this a sensory neuron, or another name for sensory neuron is afferent. Afferent neuron or sensory are exactly the same thing. All right, notice this neuron right here has an arrow. What can you tell me about this arrow? Which way is it pointing? Into the central nervous system. Here's the brain. All right, does it point the other way? Is this a double-ended arrow? It is not. That's right. So this particular neuron can only bring information from the periphery into the central nervous system. So maybe where you see this brain right here, put CNS. And what does CNS stand for? Central nervous system. And then this looks like, I don't know, gray or rose color or something. What color is this? Green. Yeah, that's really close. Oh, gray. Okay. So central nervous system. And here we see the two parts of the central nervous system, and that is the brain and the spinal cord. Brain and spinal cord make up the central nervous system. Everything outside the brain and spinal cord is what we call peripheral nervous system. All right, so the brain and spinal cord, we say, is an integration center. It receives information from the sensors all over the body, all different kinds of modalities, adds all that information up, and then makes a decision on what to do with that information, right? So, for instance, if this is a thermoreceptor instead of an eyeball right here, and if you're cold, then your central nervous system is going to warm your body back up by causing muscles to contract, shiver, right? It's going to move blood from the surface to more deep areas of your body to conserve heat. And so we call this the integration center, right? It just gets information from all over the body, makes a decision, and then it sends that decision back out to, for instance, if you're cold, right, to this muscle, and it causes this muscle to contract. On this particular slide, we see that the stimulus is the vision of a glass of water, right? And if this person is thirsty, the brain is going to think, oh, I'm thirsty, I should drink that water. Right, and so then the brain sends information out this neuron to the skeletal muscle so that you can actually drink. So this neuron, the second one here, this is what we call a motor neuron. The first one we talked about, that is a sensory neuron or afferent. This one right here is a motor neuron or an efferent. Right, so there are two kinds of neurons that are in the peripheral nervous system. Either afferent, if it's bringing information into the central nervous system, and it's efferent, if it's taking information out. Right, and where an efferent neuron takes information is to an effector organ. Here is a muscle. This is an effector organ. And then the last thing is, what does the effector organ ever produce? What does it always produce? It always produces what we call, it's called a response. Okay, so the right response right here. I want to talk about one more piece. And that is, I see another neuron, all right, and this neuron is completely within the central nervous system. It doesn't have any piece of it in the peripheral nervous system, right? So we call this an association neuron or an interneurons. Neurons that are completely within the brain and spinal cord are association neurons. Okay, so let's go over some of the pieces from top to bottom. I'm going to ask just two questions to get started. This thing right here is what we call a response loop. Sometimes we call it a reflex, but we'll just call it a response loop. And what does a reflex or a response loop always start with? A stimulus. That's why it's so important to write stimulus down here, because that's how you get your mind thinking about this loop. All right. So, and what is always the last step of a response loop? Response. That's right. So a response loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends with a response. Okay. All right. So what is able to detect the stimulus? A receptor, very good. And what always produces a response? An effector organ. Yeah, effector organ or an effector. That's really good. If you just start and end with those two pieces, then everything else kind of falls in place. All right, so what did we label on this thing? So we labeled first the stimulus, then we labeled receptor for the eye, and then we labeled this neuron bringing information into the central nervous system. That is a sensory neuron or an afferent neuron. All right, and then we got brain and spinal cord in the central nervous system. There we have association neurons. These neurons are integration centers. They gather information from all over the body, and they also make a decision what to do with that information that it's receiving from receptors all over the body. And what does it do with that information? It sends it out of the central nervous system via a motor neuron, and a name of a motor neuron is also called an efferent, right? And the efferent neuron goes to an effector organ, right? So we got effector organ right here. And effector organ then is going to produce a response, right? And if everything is working properly, this response loop, right, or reflex, the response helps this particular organism deal with its environment or internal environment, right? It's going to compensate for deficiencies, right, that different systems might have to maintain life, right? So if central nervous system is cold, right, then the effector organ is going to add heat to the body somehow to bring the temperature back up, right? If the central nervous system detects that you are dehydrated, you have a sense of thirst, right? And then drinking will then alleviate that thirsty situation. So that's the importance of a response loop. All right, so looking at this slide right here, sensory input is an afferent neuron. Integration or association neuron is always within the central nervous system, and the motor output, right, is sent out of the central nervous system via the efferent. So what's another name for an efferent neuron? Our motor. Yeah, motor neuron. That's really good. All right, the other thing that we're going to notice as we look on in the couple of chapters, right, this thing right here represents the cell body of a neuron, and then this represents a long axon. And we said this was an effector organ. Okay, I wanted to tell you something about this. I forgot what I wanted to tell you. Okay, it will come back to me. Okay. Yeah, question. Yeah, and also it depends on their function. Okay, so we're going to look at shapes of neurons, and we're going to be able to identify what the function of that neuron is by its shape. Right, so if we change the shape of a neuron, we're going to change its function. We got three major kinds of shapes of neurons, and we'll cover that in this chapter. All right, so the next picture in your book is pretty good. All right, it's this right here. It shows some divisions of the nervous system. Okay, but I think I kind of like my diagram over here on the text slide a little bit better, but we'll use both. All right, so this has to do with the basic structural divisions of the nervous system. Well, first we have central nervous system. Anybody remember what we said makes up the central nervous system? It is brain and spinal cord, right, is central nervous system. And everything outside the brain and spinal cord then we're going to call peripheral nervous system, right? And peripheral nervous system can send information into the CNS or can take information out of the CNS. All right, so the nervous system divisions. We've got CNS and peripheral nervous system. CNS is brain and spinal cord. That's pretty easy. Peripheral nervous system, we can break down into two divisions. One division that brings information into the central nervous system, that is the sensory or afferent division. The second division is bringing information from the central nervous system to the periphery, to an effector organ. We're going to call that motor or efferent. We've kind of talked about that already. All right. And on that previous slide, I need to go back to this previous slide. I asked you about these arrows, right? And you notice that they are one-way arrows. A neuron, like this one right here, like this motor neuron, can send information only in one direction, right? It can't send information back. So a motor neuron can never be a sensory neuron at the same time. That's why when you see this afferent neuron on the top, you see an arrow only pointing in one direction. And then you know it is an afferent neuron. Can't carry traffic both ways. Okay. Now, the motor division, or efferent, we can break down into two more divisions. And I think you'll probably realize what these are. One is called the somatic motor, right? So we're just talking about motor. Somatic motor versus autonomic motor. Now, you know that you have things in your body that you can't control. Anybody have an example of something you can't control? Yeah, your heart rate, for instance. Yeah, blood pressure, body temperature, whether you're thirsty or not. right? So all of these parameters, blood pressure is included in that, all of these parameters are controlled by the central nervous system, right, without your conscious thought, because you wouldn't be able to think about enough things to keep track of everything in your body, right? So the autonomic nervous system takes care of a whole bunch of different things, right? The somatic nervous system only goes to skeletal muscle, right? So in terms of the heart, we said is involuntary. What can you tell me about skeletal muscle? It is voluntary, right? So here is one way to think of somatic in this sense, right? A somatic outflow pathway, a somatic motor pathway is to skeletal muscle, and it's voluntary. You have voluntary control of that. Sometimes, for instance, in breathing, the diaphragm is skeletal muscle. You can control the diaphragm. You can hold your breath until you pass out, right? Or you can hyperventilate, and maybe you even pass out then if you hyperventilate enough, right? So diaphragm is definitely voluntary muscle, but it's kind of special because when you're sleeping, you're not thinking about breathing, right? So there is an automatic part of breathing that takes over, but it's still not the autonomic nervous system, right? It's still voluntary. So somatic versus autonomic. Autonomic takes care of all the things that you don't have to think about. And indeed, we can break the autonomic nervous system down into two major divisions. We got the major divisions right here. Sympathetic and parasympathetic are the two divisions. And we're going to, and their architecture is different. They're going to look different when we look at them on slides, right? But they're both components of the autonomic nervous system, and there's a special relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic, and it reminds me of the biceps brachii and triceps brachii. They're antagonistic to each other. That's right. So in most cases, if the parasympathetic nervous system is inhibitory, the sympathetic is excitatory. If the parasympathetic is excitatory, in most cases, the sympathetic will be inhibitory. They will always have the opposite actions. And when we get to the autonomic nervous system, I'll give you some hints on how to think about what the effects are in different places of the body. All right, so right here, all right, I see the autonomic nervous system, and I see three things. I see smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Glands shouldn't be in a smaller font. I don't know how that happened. It should be the same size font. Okay, so what are these things? You saw these things already on one of these previous slides. Okay, right here. So where does smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands fit into this first slide that we looked at? This takes a little extrapolation or interpolation of knowledge. These are effector organs. That's right. Not effector organs of the somatic nervous system or voluntary. These are effector organs of the autonomic division, right? Okay, so now you know four major classes of effector organs. You got skeletal muscle, and that belongs to the effector organ to the somatic nervous system, and then the other three are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Right, and that belongs to the autonomic nervous system. Those are the effectors of the autonomic nervous system. So, for instance, you can't control whether you're going to sweat or not. Right, that's under the control of the autonomic nervous system. Same thing for the production of saliva. You can't just be sitting here and then all of a sudden say, oh, I want to produce a lot of saliva, right? Because that just won't happen. You can maybe trick yourself. Maybe you could think of a pizza or something like that, and if you think of something like that, that will interact with the autonomic nervous system and produce some saliva, right? But you don't have direct control like skeletal muscle. All right, and I think we did this also with the heart. Did we do a heart experiment one time? Okay, your heart is not it's not under voluntary control, right? You can't control it, but just like that other example I used for saliva, you can influence your heart rate by thinking of various things, right? So you don't really control your heart, but you can influence what it does to a little degree, right? So far we've talked about a lot of information. So I think I'd like to find out where everybody is. So we're going to have a pop quiz right now. So put your books away, and I'm going to ask you some questions. What happened to your heart rate right now? So I'm just sort of kidding you, right, to demonstrate that right? You heard some stimulus from me that changed your heart rate, right? But so that's sort of interesting because you can't control your heart rate, but your instructor can control your heart rate depending on what they do, right? So different kinds of meditation can influence heart rate, but it's really not the same thing as voluntary control. All right, so when we talk about the next three chapters, I want you to refer to this diagram every single time to see what part of the nervous system we're talking about, whether it is central nervous system, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about first, and then peripheral, and then autonomic nervous system, and just kind of place it in this whole scheme of things inside your body. Okay? And this is basically the same figure that I went over. It's just a little bit more complicated, but what do you see? You see afferent and sensory divisions, you see motor, right? Motor, you got somatic and autonomic. Autonomic is broken down into sympathetic and parasympathetic. All right, so probably a really good idea to read through some of these things, but I don't know if you can have a nice picture in your mind of this slide, but you can of one over here, the text slide. All right, so keep this nice picture in your mind. All right, what about that noise in the hall? Is that disturbing anybody? Maybe a little bit, yeah? No? It is? Okay, I'm going to go over there. Unfortunately, I left the door locked, so I got to go and unlock it before I close it. Or should I just leave it locked? I'll just leave it locked. So who's ever not in class, they're stuck. You might have to go open the door for somebody. Okay. So the nervous system is important in processing information, right? That's what that first slide was all about, getting, appreciating stimulus, right, bringing it to that integration center. Then the integration center makes up its mind what it wants to do and sends that information out through the efferent pathways to various effector organs. Okay, so nervous tissue. Nervous tissue is made up of two kinds of cells, and I think we just talked about it very quickly in lab. One kind of cell is called a neuron, and the other is called a support cell or a neuroglia cell. Let's see what kind of pictures I have of these things. Okay. So let's talk about a neuron first. So here I see a nice picture of a neuron, and the neuron is in this nice gold color. And then these other things that are in a gray color, these are not neurons. These are support cells. So let's get our neuron anatomy down first. So the major part of the cell that contains the nucleus, and it contains rough endoplasmic reticulum for making what kind of stuff? Protein. Yeah, protein. So this makes a very important stuff that the nerve cell needs. That rough endoplasmic reticulum we call missile bodies, and the neuron is very busy making proteins all the time. So it really is loaded up inside the cytoplasm. So this area that contains all of the organelles, we're going to call this the cell body, or it has another name. We call it the soma, right? Soma or cell body are the same thing. That's the biosynthetic center, and it's a receptive region on a neuron. There's another receptive region on a neuron, and it's all of these projections coming out of the cell body. These are highly branched and relatively short to maybe some other projections, right? These are what we call dendrites, highly branched, short projections or processes, and this is another receptive area. So there are receptors for different kinds of chemical compounds in the dendrites, and you see many of them, right? And then another major part of this neuron is this very long projection over here, and there's only one in this particular illustration. This is what we call an axon. So those are the three main parts of a neuron. You've got dendrite, cell body, and axon. We might want to break some of these parts down into some other subregions. So let's go ahead and do that now. So notice that there's a region between the cell body and the axon, right? And I see that region right here. And it should remind you of something that you have in your kitchen, or maybe your garage, maybe the trunk of your car. Yeah, it looks like a funnel, right? And what's the job of a funnel? It's just to collect a whole bunch of stuff, right, and direct it into a very small opening in a bottle or something so that you don't lose that material. That's really the function of this thing here. It funnels information from all of these dendrites in the cell body into the axon. Right? So it really is sort of acting like a funnel. And what's the name of this region that is funneling all that information into an axon? It's called the axon hillock. That's the beginning of the axon. Right? And what it funnels in is electrical information, electrical stimulus. And the electrical stimulus then gets into an axon, and it moves as a nerve impulse all the way down to the axon tip or axon terminus. Do you see an arrow associated with this axon? Do you see an arrow anywhere on this slide? Yeah? And is it a bidirectional arrow? No. Right? Information only flows from dendrite to cell body into the axon and then down to the axon terminus. Right? And I kind of mentioned that before. This is just a one-way street. This neuron can't conduct information in both directions, only one direction. Okay, these sometimes the axon terminus, you'll see it has a little swelling at the very tip. That can be called an axon terminal. Sometimes it's called a terminal button because it contains some special structures that we're going to look at. Sometimes it's called a terminal bouton, which probably means terminal button in French. And sometimes it's called a bouton terminale, which sounds more Italian. I'm not sure what it is, but it all means the same thing. Okay, so this is a nice neuron. The particular shape that I see here with many short dendrites and one long axon, we're going to call this one a multipolar neuron. Multipolar. And the function of a multipolar neuron is that it's a motor neuron. Can you picture that from one of those first slides, a motor neuron? Right. If it's a motor neuron, where is the cell body located? Let's go back. If it's a motor neuron, where is the cell body located? In the central nervous system, and it could be the brain because it's part of the central nervous system. So you see this little dot right here? That represents the cell body of this neuron. Okay, so the cell body, and do you agree this is a motor neuron? Indeed it is, and if we were to look at a real cell, it would look like that multipolar cell. It just, we don't put it on this diagram because it would be too complicated. So this neuron right here is a multipolar neuron. The cell body is in the central nervous system, and then the axon leaves the central nervous system and goes into the peripheral nervous system. And then this is shown very nicely on that other slide as well. This is a nice correspondence. Here we see the axon terminals, right? So let's go back to that nice picture of a neuron right here. So this is dendrites and cell body will be in the central nervous system. Then the axon goes into the peripheral, and the axon terminals actually join to effector organs, right? Then the effector organs will produce some kind of response. Nice multipolar. I see some other things. I see some of these things that look like pearls that are wrapped around a part of the neuron. And these are what we call Schwann cells. Each one of these is a cell. It has a nucleus, right? And okay, and these are not neurons. They don't send electrical information, but they help the axon send electrical information. Right? They speed up the rate of a nerve impulse down an axon. That's the job of these Schwann cells. It makes the transmission of that nerve impulse very fast, hundreds of times faster than if these Schwann cells were not there. And we're going to probably talk about them in specifically in a little bit more detail. I got some really nice slides of them. So what do I see? I see a Schwann cell, and then I see an area where there is no Schwann cell. I just see an axon. And then another cell, and then a space between the cells once again, and then another cell, and a space, a space, a space. The space between cells is pretty special. It's called a node of Ranvier. The node of Ranvier is the space between cells. And because of these spaces between the cells, a nerve impulse doesn't just flow down an axon, it actually skips. Goes from one node to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And that speeds up that rate of travel, like I said, hundreds of times. All right, so I guess maybe you could think of running down the stairs. Start at the top of the room and run down the stairs. Which way would be faster, do you think? If you were to run down the stairs and step on every stair, or if you were run down the stairs and then just jump on every third one, which would be faster? And you didn't crash, right? Every third step would be a lot faster, right? Compared to if you had to step on every stair. So if you can skip steps, that would be faster. And so that nerve impulse can skip over these Schwann cells, that makes the conduction rate a lot faster. All right, so nice neuron with some support cells. And what kind of neuron is this again, by shape? Yeah, it's a multipolar neuron. And we said one of the functions of a multipolar neuron is a motor neuron. Another function is association neuron. So it has two main functions, association and motor. Can you picture that association neuron in that first slide that we looked at? Oops, right here. All right, so here is that association neuron. This little dot right here represents the cell body and dendrites of this particular cell, and then this big long line right here represents the axon of that neuron, and then this little branch right here represents the axon terminals or terminal branches of this particular multipolar neuron. All right, the sensory neuron that I see right here has a completely different shape. It's got a completely different name. We're going to get to that eventually, maybe even on the next slide. Okay, what else do we want to say about this? Well, this neuron, it has the ability to conduct electrical impulses very fast. If it's a non-myelinated fiber, it's a couple miles an hour. That's not too fast, but if it's a myelinated axon, it can be hundreds of miles an hour. So that's what we mean by fast, right? It has the ability to conduct electrical impulses very fast. Neurons live for an extremely long period of time. You might have some neurons in your body your whole lifetime. And this particular neuron, once it actually differentiates into being a competent neuron, it does not divide again by mitosis. Right? So pretty much, mostly, this is not exactly true, but most of the neurons that you have in your body right now, you've had for a very long time, and they're not undergoing mitosis. So when neurons get damaged, guess what? You just lose that particular function because they don't regenerate very well, right? And because they send this electrical information very fast and they build a lot of proteins, they have a very high metabolic rate. And they need an energy source. What's the energy source? ATP, that's right. And remember, your brain is loaded with these neurons. These neurons need a lot of ATP. And I see some mitochondria in this cell. You see some mitochondria here and here and here. What's the job of these mitochondria? To make ATP. They require oxygen in order to do that. So if blood flow to your brain is stopped, these mitochondria can't make ATP. And remember, what period of time do you have consciousness? How long can these neurons function, okay, to maintain consciousness after blood flow is stopped? Okay? Yeah, about 2 seconds, 2 to 3 seconds. I'm not sure if I mentioned this. Yeah, I think I did. Okay, 2 to 3 seconds. And then if blood flow isn't restored to those neurons in the brain, right, and these mitochondria can't make any ATP, eventually this cell is going to die. How long does that take for this cell to die when we cut off blood supply to the brain? About 2 to 3 minutes, right? So 2 to 3 seconds, the cell stops functioning. After 3 minutes, the cell is dead. So that kind of is a good example of how metabolically active these cells are. They need just to be able to make ATP all the time because it's using ATP up by sending these electrical impulses and building a bunch of macromolecules. Okay, so information in the sense of a stimulus always goes from dendrite to cell body down an axon to an axon tip. So that's something that's really important to recognize all the time. All right, let's look at some structural classifications of neurons. All right, we looked at some multipolar already. Where do we have some other kinds? Yeah, okay, we do want to talk about that now. Let's look for some different kinds of neurons. Okay, This is toward the end of the chapter, table 12.2. These used to be individual pictures, but they've kind of shrunk them down to put them in a table. So here's the one we just got done talking about, right? Cell body, bunch of short dendrites, highly branched, one long axon. This is what we call a multipolar neuron. Its function is motor and association neuron. And what I see down over here, probably it's the same color as on that first slide, like this, like the central nervous system. No, it's not the same color, is it? It's a different color scheme. Receptive region is in this blue, okay, and then the conducting region is in this other color, right, and then the sending area, secretory region, is in this third color over here. Too bad it doesn't, this is by function, not by location, as on that previous slide. All right, so we say dendrites and cell body is the receptive region, then the sending region is the axon, and then the secretion comes from the axon terminus. All right, the next kind of cell, or neuron in particular, looks like this. There's a cell body with a nucleus, and it has two really long projections coming out on either side of the cell. This is what we call a bipolar neuron. And I see some dendrites, and then I also see an axon terminus. And information still can only go from dendrite down to the axon. And if you look at this slide, it might be a little bit difficult, actually, to see the difference between this axon and dendrite. In this class, you'll be able to tell which is a dendrite and axon because we're going to place the cell in a particular location in your body. And where you find these are in organs for special sensation, like eye and smell, things like that. And then, so you know what an eyeball looks like, you know what a nose looks like, and so you know what the orientation of the cell is. So there aren't many bipolar cells, but they are important for sensation, special senses, vision, and smell. Okay, so that's the second kind. The third kind, and one that's just as important, I see a cell body, and I don't see any dendrites coming off of it, but I see one process that's kind of short, it's kind of thick, it kind of looks like an axon, but then it splits into two. Kind of reminds me of this bipolar cell over here. All right, and so we just call these processes. Here is the central process, here's the peripheral process. And the processes are named after the major division of the nervous system that you can find it. All right, so where are you going to find the peripheral process? Seems like a trick question, but it's really, really, really simple and obvious. You're going to find it in the peripheral part of the nervous system. And the central process you're going to find in the central nervous system. That's right. And the cell body is going to be in the peripheral nervous system as well. This is what we call a unipolar. Sometimes we call this a pseudo-unipolar because it looks like one axon, but it's pseudo because it bifurcates into two big ones. All right, so these right here are functioning as dendrites. This is the receptive region, all right, and then this would be the axon that's sending information down to the axon terminus. So where would we find this particular cell on this first, the first slide that we looked at? I want to put this away and just scoot way back up to the top over here. Where would we find that unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron on this diagram? It is this sensory neuron right here. All right, so here's the peripheral process, and then here is the central process, and right in this area right here, not shown on the slide, would be the cell body. I don't see a dot. I see a dot here and here, but I don't see that same dot on this particular cell. Right? But if you were to draw one in, it would be about right in this region here. All right, so here's the pseudo-unipolar. What's the shape of this association and this motor neuron? What are your choices? How many choices do you have? You got three choices. Multipolar, yeah. This one here and this one here, association and motor, are multipolar neurons. The sensory is going to be the pseudo-unipolar. Yeah.
Did you say that for the special process vision?
Yes.
Would be bipolar?
Yes. And olfaction or smell? Okay. And hearing? So those special kind of senses. Yeah. So senses, but even special ones, are the only place where we find bipolar neurons. So there aren't many of them in your body. Okay. All right, so that's what we have on the slide right here. OK, Okay, so sensory, afferent, same thing. That's the exact same terminology. Conducts impulses towards the central nervous system. Motor conducts information away from the central nervous system, and interneurons lie in between sensory and motor and are completely within the central nervous system. What's another name for an interneuron? Association neuron, right? Association, because it's associating the sensory neuron and the motor neuron together. Okay. All right. So we talked a lot about neurons. Let's talk about the second kind of cell. Right, support cells, sometimes we call these neuroglia cells or neuroglial cells, the same thing. And depending on what part of the nervous system it's in, they're going to have a little bit different shape. And it's going to be find a little bit different population of these cells. So they're going to be different whether they're in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system. Right, so let's use that classification once again and the designation once again, CNS versus peripheral nervous system. Let's look at some support cells that are in the central nervous system first. And you'll be able to recognize these by their particular shape. Okay, so now we're in the brain. And I see this nice gold-colored cell. What is the gold-colored cell? That is a neuron. Okay, that's the neuron, right? So here is the one that actually conducts the electrical impulses. I hope it's the same color as that neuron, the first multipolar neuron that we looked at. I hope. And then I see some beige-colored cells, right? And these don't look like those Schwann cells, right? But they're kind of similar. These are what we call astrocytes. There are many processes that stick off of this astrocyte. It goes in all different kinds of directions, right? And you can see that this astrocyte has one projection that goes to a neuron, right? And actually it might go to different locations on that particular neuron. And then that same cell will have projections that go to this blood vessel. All right, so this cell has a number of special functions, right? It has the ability to deliver materials from the capillary directly to this neuron. So it acts as a door-to-door delivery system. That's pretty important. Okay, and this astrocyte, because it has all of these like sun rays coming out of it in all these directions, that's why it was called an astrocyte, reminded somebody of a star up in the sky. This cell can secrete factors that stimulate the growth of neurons. Right, so, and maybe not mitosis, but maybe it can stimulate this neuron to grow new kinds of dendrites in different directions, going in different places. So this astrocyte gives your brain the ability to change its shape. And when it changes shape, it changes function, and that's one way that we can describe at a structural level long-term learning. Right, so when we learn things in the long term, the shape of these neurons change, and that is partly due to these astrocytes, because astrocytes secrete neurotrophic factors. Do I have neurotrophic factors? Brain-derived neurotrophic factor, right? That helps enlarge the network of neurons. Okay, so what else is happening right here? Well, as you're taking a fairly rigorous class like anatomy or physiology and micro, you're learning all kinds of stuff. Right, you're just cramming all kinds of information into your brain. What's happening to the shape of your brain? It's changing. That's right. So just by learning all this information, the shape of these neurons are changing, their connections are changing, and I'm always amazed that my students always hand their brains over to me so that I can rebuild them. That's really amazing. If I were you, I'd be scared. Right, be careful who you hand your brain over to, who you listen to, what kind of information, right, gets into your brain, because it changes the shape of your brain. You learn those things. And the brain really, that's the one of the primary things that a brain likes to do. And it likes to learn. That's one of the main things that the brain likes to do. And a lot of times, you know, it doesn't know what's good or bad. I'll talk about that in just a little bit. But it likes to learn and repeat behaviors. All right, so some things that are delivered door-to-door from the blood to this neuron would be glucose. Glucose is a molecule that mitochondria can use to make ATP. All right, so glucose gets delivered directly to this neuron to keep those mitochondria happy and making ATP for us. If we look at this capillary, we see that in this segment of the capillary, it's completely surrounded by these processes from an astrocyte. All right, and that's pretty important, because this blood vessel right here has a special ability that allows for exchange of material. Things that are in the blood can leave the blood and go into tissue spaces at a capillary. Things that are in tissue spaces can leave the brain and go into a capillary. And that could only happen at a capillary. Can't happen at a vein, can't happen in an artery, only a capillary, because they're leaky. So anything that's in the blood would be able to get into the brain, including lots of toxins. And so what system has evolved to help protect the brain is called the blood-brain barrier. And here I can see the blood-brain barrier. It's produced by astrocytes, and it keeps many harmful compounds out of the brain. Because remember, how important is the brain? What is it doing? It's controlling your blood pressure, your body temperature, respiratory rate, right? Electrolyte balance, water balance, all kinds of things via the autonomic nervous system. Without a functioning brain, we wouldn't be able to maintain life, right? So these toxic compounds in blood should not have direct access to these neurons because they're so important. All right, so that's a couple functions of this astrocyte. A little bit later on, I'm going to mention another function of an astrocyte. Another kind of cell looks like this, almost looks similar, okay, but the processes are more highly branched. I don't see any, and they're shorter. I don't see them going to a blood vessel. And actually, this thing kind of reminds me of a Langerhans cell. Where did you run into a Langerhans cell? In the Langerhans cell was in the epidermis, right? Epidermis of the skin. Can anybody remember what the function of that Langerhans cell was? Okay, it was for immune response. It helps protect you from infection, right, in the skin. Another name for that Langerhans cell, remember, was called a dendritic cell. And what does that kind of remind you of when you hear dendrite? What does that kind of remind you of? What are you thinking? I'm thinking like a piece of a neuron or something, right? Dendritic, right? Dendrite. So this right here is what we call a microglia cell or a dendritic cell, and its function is for immune response. So this thing actually can move around between cells in your brain, and it's looking for things that don't belong in your brain. All right, this microglia cell does that for immune response. And so what kind of things don't belong in your brain? What kind of other cells don't belong in your brain that it will want to get rid of? Like bacteria, fungi, things like that, other kinds of infectious agents, maybe virus if we're lucky, okay, and if we're lucky, even tumor cells, right? But microglia cells cannot always recognize tumor cells. So it's really great if it does, because then it will kill that tumor before the person even knows that they have a tumor or cancer growing in their brain. And probably we have all had tumors growing in our brain, but never recognized it because of what? These microglia cells that killed that tissue before it became a problem for us. Okay, so immune response, important for the microglia cell. Another kind of cell, all right? There are big spaces inside the brain, big cavities inside the brain filled with fluid. We'll take a look at what that fluid does, all right? And that fluid is produced by these cells that line the cavity. These are called ependymal cells. And I can see that these ependymal cells even have some cilia on them as well. It secretes that fluid into those cavities that we call ventricles. That fluid is called cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebrospinal fluid. So where do you find cerebrospinal fluid? The answer is in the name. Brain and spinal cord, that's right. So sometimes we just call it CSF because we don't always want to say cerebrospinal fluid all the time. We just call it CSF. So make sure you don't hear cerebral spinal fluid, you hear cerebro, right? We combine terms in anatomy as long as we put an O between them. okay, come from these ependymal cells. And these ependymal cells also act as a little barrier between the fluid, the CSF, cerebrospinal fluid, and the brain. It helps protect the brain from things that could be in those ventricles. All right, so those are ependymal cells. And then the last kind, and still this is, I see it wrapping around an axon, and I see another piece of this cell wrapping around an axon, and another piece wrapping around an axon. What does this kind of remind you of? We've talked about it on that first multipolar neuron that we looked at. Maybe I'll go back. I hear it. It's coming to the surface of some of your memories. It reminds me of a Schwann cell. Okay, because a Schwann cell wrapped itself around an axon. Okay, the difference between a Schwann cell and this one right here that we call an oligodendrocyte, oh, there's that dendro term again, oligodendrocyte, is that oligodendrocytes are found in the central nervous system. Schwann cells are always found in the peripheral nervous system. But one of their functions is exactly the same. It speeds the rate of a nerve impulse down an axon. It increases the speed of nerve conduction. So that's the beauty of these myelinated axons. They're fast. So this kind of reminds me of a little commercial that has been shown a bunch. I haven't seen it lately, but it kind of goes, what's better, faster or slower? What would you say? Yeah, faster is better, right? There's a bus coming at you. The sooner you can get out of the way, the better you are. If you're not fast enough to get out of the way, then that's too bad, right? So fast conducting axons are much better than slow ones. Okay, so in the central nervous system, that's due to oligodendrocytes. In the peripheral nervous system, it is a Schwann cell. All right, so all of the cells that we look at, oligodendrocytes, right, ependymal cells, microglia cells, and astrocytes, all of these are found in what major division of the nervous system? Central nervous system, right. All right, so then we only have to get to the peripheral nervous system, and here we see the support cells in the peripheral nervous system. Here's a Schwann, here's one, and it's wrapping itself around what? An axon of a neuron, and that speeds the rate of a nerve impulse. Okay, what are these little spaces between Schwann cells called? Node of Ranvier, and that's where that nerve impulse skips from one node to the next, to the next, to the next. All right, and what kind of neuron are we looking at? Okay, here are the Schwann cells. Schwann cell, not a neuron. Okay, but I do see a neuron right here because of the color. It kind of stands out. What color is that?
Yellow.
Yeah, so the yellow, if you look at that yellow cell, what shape does it have? You should be able to tell me the shape of that cell, and once you know the shape of that cell, you can tell me what the function is. It is a, I just see one projection coming out that splits into two pretty soon. Pseudo-unipolar. Yeah, so don't get tricked into thinking bipolar, because the bipolar actually has two major processes coming out. This one only has one, so it's called pseudo-unipolar. What's the function of pseudo-unipolar? Function of pseudo-unipolar is sensory. What's another name for sensory? It is afferent. Afferent neuron or sensory. Okay. Well, I know I'm asking you a lot of questions and you're not familiar with this stuff, but maybe after lecture, if you listen to lecture on the tape once again, and if I ask you that question again, hopefully some of these answers start coming to you, right? So even the tape is not really interactive, but if I ask you on the tape, try to say the answer before I say it in class. And then it sort of becomes interactive for you, right? Just that static recording. All right, so I see a pseudo-unipolar neuron. I see some Schwann cells. And then I see some other nervous system cells that surround the cell body of that pseudo-unipolar neuron. And we call these satellite cells. So the cell bodies of these neurons are surrounded by satellite cells, and these satellite cells just maintain the health of this particular neuron. Satellite cells don't send electrical impulses, but they help the pseudo-unipolar neuron do its job and protect it as well. And they're called satellite cells because where do you see them? All the way around the cell body, that's right. And so when somebody first saw, and nuclei usually stand out very nicely, right? So when somebody first found the cell, they saw the nucleus of the neuron, and then they found a bunch of other nuclei like circling around it. And so they were just thinking of the solar system model in their mind, and so they said, oh, well, that reminds me of the moon around the Earth or planets around the sun, so we're going to call these satellite cells. Okay. Remember, they're not neurons, they're support cells. Okay. All right, let's look at what are some other nice things we should be looking at. Okay, let's look at how myelin or Schwann cell works. All right, so here I see a nice axon, right, kind of a narrow tube carrying information, electrical impulses, nerve impulses move along this axon. And here's the Schwann cell. You know what the function of that is? Speeds that conduction up. And here is the cytoplasm of a Schwann cell. Here's the nucleus, and then here's the cell membrane. Well, when the myelin, when the Schwann cell is developing around this axon, right, it just kind of surrounds the axon, but it doesn't stop there. It keeps wrapping itself around and around and around the axon. So I see lots of layers, right? It almost kind of reminds me maybe of a bone, cross-section of a bone tissue, right? We call that lamella, but we don't call these lamella in a Schwann cell, but I kind of see them there, right? And as it's wrapping itself around, all the cytoplasm, including this nucleus, gets trapped in that outer layer, right? That outer layer that contains cytoplasm and the nucleus and all those other organelles, we're going to call that the neurolemma. Neurolemma is the living part of this Schwann cell, including endoplasmic reticulum, which is going to be making a really fancy lipid molecule. And that lipid molecule is called myelin. Myelin ends up in these inner layers of the Schwann cell as it's wrapping around the axon. And that lipid is an insulator. It acts like insulation on a wire, right? So it prevents the leakage of current out of this axon into the interstitial space. And as a result, right, that helps speed the rate of this nerve impulse down because the electrical properties can't leak out of the cell. It's contained inside the cell. So that's the job of this Schwann cell. So the Schwann cell has two main areas. It has one layer that we call the neurolemma, and then it has many layers deep to the neurolemma that we call the myelin sheath because these layers are filled with what compound? Myelin. And myelin acts as an insulator to keep those, to keep the electricity, one way of saying it, the electricity inside this axon so it doesn't leak out. So it actually finds its way all the way down to the axon terminus. All right, so that's pretty good. Sometimes it's hard to find what this neurolemma is, but this slide shows it very, very nicely. All right, so and oligodendrocytes kind of are this, work the same way. They wrap themselves around and around and around an axon in the central nervous system, and those sheets that wrap around contain myelin as well. All right, but an oligodendrocyte doesn't have a neurolemma because it really has a cell body. Okay. All right, so what's the structural and functional unit of life called? A cell. Yeah. Let's see, what else? Did we talk about another structural and functional unit in here yet? Ah, we talked about muscle. Nice, yes. Structural and functional unit of contraction is the sarcomere. The beauty of that concept is once you understand one sarcomere, you know how, pretty much how all muscle works, right? And if you know something about one cell, you pretty much know how every cell behaves because of the organelles are the same. All right, well, we're going to get to another structural and functional unit right now. And it's called a synapse. A synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And one good example would be communication between two neurons. So let's take a look and see what we have. I want to look at these. Ah, okay, let's look at this slide right here. All right, so I see this nice yellow cell. We know that to be a neuron, and I see that this the axon here, and what can you tell me about this axon? How about the rate of impulse conduction, fast or slow? Fast, because it's myelinated, right? And then here are a bunch of dendrites, and what end of the neuron are these dendrites on, the sending end or the receiving end? Yeah, it's the receiving end. As a matter of fact, when I look at all these dendrites right here, right, it kind of reminds me of antennae, an antenna on a TV set or a radio. Who's ever seen an antenna on a TV set? A couple? All good. All right. I don't want to use an analogy that just doesn't make any sense anymore. Okay. Well, and an antenna does what on a TV set? It receives signals, right? So think of these as antenna. It doesn't function exactly the same way, but kind of similar, right? But I see another cell on this particular illustration, and I see a second axon way up over here from a second cell. The cell body is not drawn. The dendrites on this cell are not drawn. We only see the axon, and this axon comes down and splits, right? There are branches to it, and then it bumps into the dendrites of the first cell that we were talking about. So I see two cells, two neurons. This junction between the two neurons is what we call a synapse. So therefore, we call the cell that has this axon that's coming down, we call this the presynaptic neuron because it's coming before the synapse. And then the one that we see in its entirety right here, we call this the postsynaptic neuron because we see it after the synapse. All right, so you guys want to know a lot about this synapse right now because we got these two neurons, the pre and postsynaptic neurons. Okay, so let's zoom into this area. Remember I said that these axon terminals have a little swelling, a little bouton or button. If we zoom way in, here's what a terminal button looks like, and we see some structures on the inside of it. Right, so all synapses are going to work like this. Right, I also see mitochondria, because what does this area of the neuron need? A lot of ATP, right? Needs a lot of ATP, requires a lot of energy. These are vesicles inside the terminal button. And if you look inside of a vesicle, do you see anything? Or does it kind of look all homogeneous or empty? Do you see something in there? Yeah, I see some things in there. Those are molecules. And these molecules are what we're going to call neurotransmitters. Neuro because these vesicles are in a neuron, and a transmitter because it's going to help transmit information from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. Okay, so those are neurotransmitters. I see some microtubules. Microtubules mean what? It can move things around inside of a cell. So these microtubules help position where these vesicles are, or if they're stationary, or if they're moving around, they can bump into this membrane. This is the membrane of what? The presynaptic or postsynaptic cell? Yeah, this is the pre. So we call this the presynaptic membrane. And if we go across the space between them, then we get to the postsynaptic membrane. That space between the pre and postsynaptic membranes is called the synaptic cleft. It's just interstitial fluid, extracellular fluid. Okay, and it's a pretty small space. All right, so when a nerve impulse comes down the axon, and indeed it's only one direction, that causes some electrical changes in this terminal button, which then forces these vesicles over to the presynaptic membrane. They fuse together, and then whatever inside that vesicle is released into the synaptic cleft. What do we call that process? Exocytosis would be good, right? Or if you want to say secretion, that would be good too, depending on what kind of terminology you want to use. Right, so neurotransmitter is exocytosed into the synaptic cleft, and then it's going to move. It's going to move from an area of high concentration right by the presynaptic membrane to an area of low concentration by the postsynaptic membrane. What do we call it when something moves from high concentration to low concentration without any energy required, just passive? Yeah, that is diffusion. So the neurotransmitter diffuses from the presynaptic membrane to the postsynaptic membrane. And this neurotransmitter is a signaling compound, right? And so what does this postsynaptic cell have to have in order to sense this particular stimulus? Right? Yeah, this neurotransmitter is going to be a stimulus to the postsynaptic cell. So that means that the postsynaptic cell has to have a receptor to this particular neurotransmitter. And the neurotransmitter will bind to the receptor, and then that's going to change the behavior of the postsynaptic cell. The way that we understand why a neurotransmitter binds to a receptor is by just the shape of the molecule. All right, so the receptor has to have a complementary shape to the shape of the neurotransmitter. So if the shape of the neurotransmitter changes, it can no longer bind to the receptor. Or if the shape of the receptor changes, it can no longer bind the neurotransmitter and the system won't work. All right, so again, shape is very important. All right, if we change the shape of the neurotransmitter, what changes? The function of the synapse changes, right? Okay, so what I want you also to see on this slide is that information is transmitted, right, on this neuron, right, the presynaptic neuron, right here, presynaptic neuron, as an electrical signal, a nerve impulse. Right, when it gets down to this terminal button, that electrical information is converted into chemical information. The chemical information then moves across the synapse, and when it binds to the postsynaptic cell, it initiates another electrical event. So the way information goes across this particular synapse is electrical, chemical, electrical. All right? These three steps, electrical, chemical, electrical. Since a chemical or a neurotransmitter is used to carry information across the synaptic cleft, we call this a chemical synapse. A general name for this is a chemical synapse. So all chemical synapses have these vesicles filled with neurotransmitter, right? And the postsynaptic cell is always going to have receptors. And just like information moves only in one direction in a neuron, which is what? Dendrite cell body axon. Information can only flow in one direction across the synapse. And now we have to think, why does information only flow in one direction across the synapse? I know two reasons why. Can anybody see a reason why information only goes from the pre to the postsynaptic cell? Yeah, because one cell is going to send information via a neurotransmitter, and only one cell has a neurotransmitter to send someplace. What is the cell that has the neurotransmitter? It is the presynaptic cell. So only the presynaptic cell can send information, right? Not the postsynaptic cell. So the postsynaptic cell can't send information to the pre because it doesn't have neurotransmitter, right? Sort of a corresponding reason. All right, what does the postsynaptic cell have to have in order to sense the neurotransmitter from the presynaptic cell? Yeah, it's got to have a receptor. And only the postsynaptic cell has a receptor. The presynaptic cell does not. All right, so the presynaptic cell can't receive information because it doesn't have a receptor. Hence, information can only go from the pre to the postsynaptic cell. All right, so that's a really good example of a chemical synapse. All right, synaptic knob. Okay, let me just say a couple other things. All right, in order for these vesicles to move over to the presynaptic membrane for secretion of the neurotransmitter, when this nerve impulse comes down to this terminal button right here, the signal that's used to move these vesicles around is calcium. Calcium has to enter the nerve from the extracellular space. All right, so when the nerve impulse comes down, calcium is allowed to enter from the extracellular space into the terminal button, and then the vesicles move over to the presynaptic membrane. So that's a pretty important reason to have proper levels of calcium in our body. Right, because it's necessary for neurons to communicate with each other through a synapse. When neurons communicate with each other through a synapse, we call that synaptic transmission. And the ion most responsible for synaptic transmission is what ion? Calcium. Yeah, calcium ion. Okay, sodium plays a role with that nerve impulse, but calcium is important for secretion of this neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. Okay, so what do you know about calcium? Where is it? Why is it important in your body? What are some of its functions? Calcium. It makes bones strong. Do you want to have strong bones? Yeah, because you don't want them to fracture spontaneously. Definitely you want strong bones. Do you know another place where you should have calcium besides bones? Oh, muscle contraction. That's right. You need calcium for muscle contraction to get those sarcomeres. Shortening, sliding of myofilaments over each other, need calcium. Think of anything else? What else might calcium be important for in your body? It allows neurons to communicate with each other via this chemical synapse. So calcium is important not only for strong bones, muscle contraction, but also for synaptic transmission. Right? It allows neurons to communicate with each other. So when your body starts to run low on calcium, where does your body choose to put this calcium? Where would you choose to put it? So that your brain and central nervous system function? So that your muscles function? Or so you have strong bones? You say, well, gee, I don't like a choice. I would like to have it everywhere, right? Well, the best place to get rid of calcium, to lose calcium, is bones, right? Because you definitely need muscle contraction for breathing, right? You definitely need a nervous system to control everything. Probably the third least important place is bones. But, of course, we don't like to lose so much calcium that our bones get brittle. What do we call that disease process? Osteoporosis. And fortunately, there are ways that we can retard the development of osteoporosis and, in some cases, prevent it altogether. And what do we have to do to prevent osteoporosis so that we can have synaptic transmission, good strong muscles, and good strong bones all at the same time? Okay. Exercise and diet, two main things. But don't forget, diet requires two components, vitamin D and calcium. That's right. So diet and exercise, and the kind of exercise is an exercise that puts stress on bones, like weight-bearing kinds of exercises. Okay. Helps prevent osteoporosis. And that also protects what? Your nervous system as well, later on in life. Okay, what do I want you to know? Okay, I'm going to simplify some of these things on this slide. And it has to do with resting membrane potential. I don't think your book has a single picture about resting membrane potential, but I want to mention this, right, because it will help you when you get into a physiology class. So I'm going to bring this neuron back up. All right, so there's a difference in the solution that's inside the cell. What do we call all this junk inside the cell? Cytoplasm, that's right. Cytoplasm has a different composition compared to the fluid that is outside the cell in that extracellular space. Okay, and so there's a difference in concentration of chemicals across the cell membrane, but that's not the only other thing. There is a difference in electrical charge. Right? And electrical charge, I just mean that there are molecules that have a plus charge running around in there and some molecules that have a negative charge. And we call these things ions. Maybe you've heard of some of these ions. As a group, they're also called electrolytes because they have an electrical charge. Right? So has anybody worked in a clinic or hospital or a situation like that and somebody was very concerned about electrolytes? Anybody hear something like that? Or am I just really dragging people into a place where they've never been and never want to go and don't want to know anything about? I see some people nodding their heads. Electrolytes are very important. These are little small ions like calcium and sodium that have an electrical charge. They have an uneven distribution across the cell membrane, right? And it makes the inside of the cell negative compared to the outside. So the outside is positive compared to the inside, which is negative. And it's due to those electrolytes. So every cell, okay, has these two areas, an area that is negative and an area that is positive outside. You have some devices like this. Everybody, I'm sure, has a device like that in their pocket. Maybe two of these devices in their pocket. Can anybody read my mind and think what I'm thinking? What device do you have in your pocket that separates the electrical charge into two locations? Somebody says a cell phone, that's true. It's not the whole cell phone, it's just one component of the cell phone that makes it work, and that is the battery. That's right. Okay, so every cell acts like a battery because it can separate electrical charge. Now, what do you call that battery in your cell phone when it doesn't have an electrical charge on it anymore? Yeah, it's a dead battery. You have a cell where there's no electrical charge across the membrane. Guess what you can tell me about that cell? It's dead as well, right? So that is very important. So that voltage sometimes is called a potential. Potential and voltage is exactly the same thing. It's that separation and charge. When the cell is at rest, not doing anything, we call that the resting membrane potential. All right, and I'm going to have to take up from there next time. We're going to finish up resting membrane potential and talk a little bit about an action potential, and then a couple other things before we're done with this chapter. The sign-in sheet is going around.